You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Now, it's time for Playing with Fire with Chef Tom and Stu at the new 104.7 WHLI. Brought to you by Santa Giada Pinot Grigio.
But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shortell, broadcasting to all you food-crazed lunatics out there. And I'm here with co-host and producer, Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. You actually look exhausted.
Well, I've had quite the week, you know. Lots of parties, lots of things going on. We're doing a minimum of 150 a day. Again, looking forward to today, Father's Day. And let's wish all the fathers out there happy Father's Day. We hope you got more than a tie and a spatula. And it's funny, Mother's Day, everybody takes, you know, mom out to dinner. If you don't take mom out to dinner, you lose your membership in the sibling society, right? So you got to do that. Father's Day is a little different. They just usually hand out a tie and a spatula and say, go out in the back and, you know, fire up the barbecue.
I wonder,
and maybe watch the U.S. Open.
Yeah, I wonder if it's the timing. I mean, obviously, it's a little deeper into the season and it's more barbecue weather than the beginning of May. Also, it's graduation time, and in today's world, there's very few Father's Day celebrations that aren't a combo, that are graduation Father's Day.
Yeah, it's true.
And still, at this point, there's, you know, so many families are first really coming out of COVID and really starting to socialize and travel. Yeah. And what better time to travel than with gas, $5, $6 a gallon?
Oh, it's perfect. I mean, it seems to be our government types can't wait to turn us into Venezuela. And they're hell-bent on doing it. It's hilarious. I was reading this thing on electric cars and how much they cost to power the batteries and it's nuts. We don't have the technology yet, you know. Fine, you want to buy an electric car, great. But, why don't we wait until the technology is there, you know, before we turn the whole country upside down. But, you know, they can't wait to do it. It's hilarious.
Well, it is interesting, not to get too deep into it, but this thing with electric cars and stuff, I am finding that if you get a comparable electric car to your traditional gas car, if it's a lease, it could be $250 more a month.
Yeah, that's great. Well, and then, you know, to charge it, it takes 10 hours to charge those batteries, you know. I mean, you know, the electricity grid is powered by gasoline, you know. The whole thing is so good.
Well, what would be interesting is we fortunately haven't had any power failures in recent times, but probably 10 years ago we did. And would that stagnate, like, everybody's means to transport?
It would.
If you couldn't charge your car?
Well, I mean, yeah, if everybody on your block has an electric car, I mean, the grid's not going to be able to support it, you know, from what I've read. And so the whole thing is just it's a fairy tale waiting to happen. And I think that's the reason gas prices are being forced up to $5, $6, $8 a gallon, because nobody's going to buy an electric car when gas is $2 a gallon, you know what I mean? So we have
I'm not that smart. And I never started really thinking about it, but what a convenient reason to help push people to the healthier, supposedly healthier, or ecologically proper means of transportation. But yeah, it was. I just remember reading all the trades way back when, and there was a lot of. There just wasn't a lot of push. The consumers weren't accepting the electric cars very much.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's all a buzz because, just like you said, the price of the gas is up and people don't really. analyze it.
Yeah, there's an agenda out there for sure. You know, listen, I'm, you know, to tie this back to food, I'm you know, for all for green. You know, I mean, you know, it's better for the vegetables. It's better for, you know, a lot of us. But there is a reality to some of this stuff. I mean, can you imagine what, you know, electric, you know, tractor trailer trucks are going to cost? A, to run. B, to charge. C, to, you know, it's just, it's going to drive everything.
There you go again. I actually didn't think about that. I just, again, I get involved in the weirdest times, but I went to Westbury Manor for a celebration recently, and somebody was all upset because they needed to charge their Tesla.
Yeah.
And they didn't have a special charging station there, but I guess you can still charge it with a regular electric cord or something, and an adapter.
Yeah.
And the guy goes, oh no, this is going to be the slow mode. You know, hopefully by the time the party's over, I might have a little bit of power.
Yeah, whoa. Please. The whole thing's ludicrous to me. But anyway, you know, bringing it back to food again, which we have to do occasionally. You know, I grew up kind of around the corner from Westbury Manor. I mean, it was, you know, 7, 8, 10 blocks away, but it was essentially around the corner because, you know, Westbury Manor is really Carr Place Manor. It's in Carr Place. You know, it may have a Westbury address. I don't know, but I don't think so. Anyway, so it was always Carl Hoppel's Westbury Manor. You remember him, Carl Hoppel?
Oh, wow.
He was a big restaurateur.
I obviously am familiar with the name, and yeah, I knew there was some sort of restaurant or something. I had no idea that that was what today is Westbury Manor.
Yeah, it was Carl Hoppel's Westbury Manor, and he had Carl Hoppel's in Huntington. He had this A-frame building that was set back off the road on 25A. And I believe he had 3 or 4 other restaurants on.
I think there must have been something on the South Shore.
There was, yeah.
Maybe not a catering home, maybe just a restaurant. But the name is legendary.
Yeah, he had one, I believe, I want to say it was America. I'm kind of shady on it because it was in the 60s. And I remember when I finally got, you know, it under my skin that I was going to be in the restaurant business for the rest of my miserable life, I always wanted to be him. I wanted to be Carl Hoppel. I want to, you know, have multiple restaurants. I had this dream, you know, that I would, you know, somehow be as successful as Carl Hoppel. And, you know, I'll let everybody else judge whether it happened or not. But I know I had more restaurants than him, that's for sure. But he was an old German fellow who was schooled over there, and he came. He ran these restaurants that had, they were considered the higher-end restaurants at the time. You know, you had the Lincoln Inn down in Rockville Center, and you had Carl Hoppel's, where they used to do, you know, the tableside cooking, the flaming desserts, the Caesar salad at the table, boning the fish at the table. And those were the places that I wanted to work as a kid because those were the, you know, they were the hot stuff restaurants on Long Island at the time. And that kind of service sort of went the way of the Whigs, but I see a little bit of it coming back. And, you know, we try and do a little of that at the restaurants. You know, we'll pour the soup tableside, or, you know, you know, the talent in the dining room, and I don't mean this to disparage anybody. They're great waiters out there, but there's not a lot of people who know how to do that stuff anymore because it's been so long since it's been popular. You know, my generation, those guys probably remember. The manager of the club that I work with, Don, you know, he used to do that all the time. He says, you know, anytime you want to do a Dover sole, I can bone a fish, I can bone a duck, you know, whatever. I'm like, all right, great, but what if we get 20 of them, you know, how are you going to do it? You know, you can't do it by yourself. So, you know, we're trying to train the wait staff over there. The problem with country clubs is a lot of them are non-tipping clubs, you know, so the wait staff at the clubs aren't your, you know, high-end, top-notch waiters. They're, you know, a lot of them are kids in summer school or whatever, and you know, they're just basically delivery people. So it's hard to train somebody who can't take a, you know, a cocktail order into, you know, a top-flight waiter in 2 months, you know. So it's been a challenge, to say the least. I've gone through all 7 stages of grief. I'm almost to acceptance now.
So
I went
funny.
From anger to sadness to crying to anxiety, and now I'm slowly accepting the fact that this is what I have to work with, you know. It's pretty funny.
That is very funny. So I have to thank our audience. We actually had a lot of exchange of information over the weekend, a number of emails.
Really?
And if you don't mind, I'd like to read a couple of them.
I don't mind. I probably couldn't prevent it anyway.
This one we went over before the show started, but we were talking last week about a couple of restaurants that I had stopped by the week before, and we got a email from Emily from Lynbrook, and she goes, "Hi, Chef Tom and Stu. I was listening to your show today and was thrilled to hear your comment about the Pantry Diner. I totally agree with what you had to say. It has truly become an asset to Oceanside." And she goes on to say that she is from Lynbrook and would love us to come visit a restaurant called Luvomo Restaurant on Atlantic Avenue in Lynbrook. And she says that it's a fine Italian restaurant. The ownership is very, very nice and pleasant. The staff, here we go. There's a segue. The staff is great, and the food is very delicious. So, Emily, thank you for yours.
Yeah, I'm always looking to go to a new restaurant. Thanks for the tip. I'll definitely check it out.
So here's one, and I haven't read this one yet. So,
uh-oh.
But we had the Gullo family was Fresh Fin Gourmet was sponsoring the show for a while. And this is a letter, an email from Tom and Pam from Levittown. "Dear Tom, we tried the Gullo's fully cooked octopus. We tried it just warmed on the grill with the supplied octopus sauce as an appy. Very nice.
Hmm.
The next night, sliced very thin with ravioli and some tomato sauce. Also, very nice. We also noticed a new restaurant, Caribbean Style, in East Meadow, just west of Newbridge Road. They recommend reservations, will only hold 15 minutes, and there is a $15 charge for any in the party that do not show."
Good luck.
Do you have
with
any
that.
Comments on that, Tom?
I do. I'll get to them as soon as you're done.
That was that one. But they came back also with another one. This one says, "Test. Just to let you know, I've sent last week and a few previous weeks. Oh, we haven't been talking about things enough." All good. Let's see if we got. Oh, Bill O'Leary. Wow, this is a long one. "Hello, Tom and Stu. Just wanted to send a note saying that I'm still here."
Nice.
"After stalking you at Nunzi's and down in South Carolina," never, "I figured I'd lay low for a while. Actually, I've been catching up on all your podcasts on WHLI.com.
Nice.
So, yes, if anyone goes to WHLI.com, there should be a button or an ad, a picture of Playing with Fire. And if you go into that, there's previous episodes that you can listen. And I have to think, Tom, that, you know, podcasts are all the norm right now.
Yeah, yeah.
And essentially a podcast is a radio show that's listened to on demand. But you've been doing this for like 15 years already, and there was no such thing as a podcast back then.
We had some, but then some genius wiped them all out. You remember that?
I mean, right, but I'm saying other than you, again, these weekly shows that were held in a library and people could go to at leisure.
Yeah.
Didn't exist. So you're on the cusp of technology.
Anybody who knows me would have one hard laugh about that because I can't even find my messages on my iPhone. You know?
So to communicate with us, it's fire@whli.com. And if you would like to listen to previous episodes of Playing with Fire, you can go to whli.com and look for the information about the show, and you can click through right there. So Bill O'Leary goes on to say, "There are some great shows posted on the website. Mostly I've already heard, but also a few I've missed." And he goes on to say, "One place Tom mentioned a few times, Luigi Q's, was on my list to try. Told some friends and they checked out the menu online and we set up a day to go. Unfortunately, they are closed on Sundays, so we will plan another day to go." That's always amazing to me that restaurants are closed on Sundays, some restaurants.
Yeah, you know, I don't know what that is. I mean, everybody needs a day off for sure. You know, Sundays aren't a busy day in a lot of areas, you know. Like Sunday was, I remember even at Jewel, I mean, Sunday was a kind of a quiet day, you know. It's sort of, I don't know. Maybe it's a traditional family barbecue, sit-at-home day or whatever. I don't know.
Well, that's why I find the internet interesting, because you can quickly find out about things.
Yeah.
But, there's restaurants that are closed on Sundays. There are restaurants that are closed on Mondays. There are restaurants that are closed on Tuesdays.
I'm one of those. I'm a Tuesday guy out east because and somebody once asked me, why do you close a restaurant on Tuesday instead of Monday? I said, well, because every once in a while you get a holiday that falls on a Monday. You want to be open for that, you know? Plus, the other thing is most of my colleagues are closed on Monday. So, you know, for me to close on Tuesday makes sense because I can grab some of that business that they would ordinarily go to another place.
See, that's interesting because when we had the gentleman in from Encime Wines, the tasting room at Oceanside, I asked him about that. And I said, you know, there's some holidays coming up, Labor Day and Memorial Day, July 4th and stuff like that. And he wasn't sure if, you know, people actually would be going out. And to me, I actually thought they would, but he was still feeling through the fact that it was a new establishment and didn't know which way it was going to go.
You know, my experience on the Monday thing is that, you know, those holiday weekends, Sundays become busier. Sunday can be like a Saturday night because everybody's off on Monday. But Monday is like a Sunday. It's just a draggy day. Everybody's had it already and going home or whatever they're doing, you know.
So just to finish Bill O'Leary's email to us, he goes, in a previous email, I mentioned that my wife, Dawn, here we go, he's going to score points, and I will be celebrating our 50th anniversary.
Wow.
And we'll be staying at Ohiga Castle the end of June. We'll try to hit one of Tom's other suggestions and enjoy a nice lunch or dinner, and we'll make sure to say Tom and Stu sent us.
Nice.
It's also great to hear about Tom's new book coming out soon. I'd like to pre-order 2 copies and we'll probably pick up a couple more as Christmas gifts, and would be great to have them signed by both Tom and you. Holy cow.
How did you get involved in this?
Wow. Now I really am feeling humbled.
I'm dragging you into the celebrity spotlight.
Wow. That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool.
That is cool.
Oh, here we go. I strap yourself in, Tom.
Wait a minute.
I figure a Stu Schrager autograph might score some big bucks on eBay. Laugh out loud. One copy will be going to my friend Steve Mattello, and who was a teacher at Call Place High School.
Really? Wow. Must have been after
Steve
me.
Steve also coached Roger Vi on the lacrosse team.
That was Roger Vi Jr.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
One last thing. Let me know the next time you're in South Carolina. It would be great to have a meal with you. We're going down August 2nd. Keep up the great work, guys, and hopefully get some more podcasts online.
Nice. All right. Well, it's nice to have a little audience interaction. It's good to know that people are listening out there. We're not doing this in vain, you know. It's funny. I get people all the time that come up to me and tell me that they listen to the show. So, you know, and the great news is now at least I'm going to sell 5 books.
Yeah. I'm a little concerned, though, because, well, fortunately, Tom carries a spoon in his chef's coat.
My pocket.
Because if it was the paring knife, it might be after that one.
Cut Stew. Yeah, I didn't know that you're going to increase the value of my books. This is great. We can do a signing together. The Tom and Stew Show.
I hope I'm available.
Yeah. Oh, God. You know, it's funny. We had, my book is... Always, well, the first book was about my 100 wackiest customers, you know. And since there's no shortage of talent out there, we had the second book is called The Second Helping. And it's more of the same. And I think that'll be the end of it for me. I don't want to be this one-trick pony. But, you know, I tell these tales for a couple of reasons. One is that I think they're funny, you know. Admittedly, from mildly amusing to knee slapping, you know. But the more interesting part of why I do it is to kind of scratch the itch of these people who apparently need a lot more attention than everybody else. And that's what it always comes down to, all this restaurant angst that they, you know, they create with the sauces on the side and this, and I can't sit there, and bring me over here. And again, I mean, there's a woman who frequents one of my places, and every time she has a salad, the dupe, the ticket that comes into the kitchen is about a foot and a half long. It's like, who wrote this thing? Tolstoy? I mean, it's like nuts, you know? And she can make a Shakespearean tragedy out of a Caesar salad.
So that's very funny. So going back to the Pantry Diner, I ordered a chef salad, but I didn't, I don't like ham necessarily.
Right.
And roast beef, It's sometimes too rare. So I just wanted cheese and turkey.
Right.
But what was really cool is I guess they were taking the order on an iPad.
Yeah.
And I guess when they call up the entree, it actually has like a description of what it includes, which is pretty interesting because how many times have you gone to a restaurant and there's an item and you talk about wanting to know, you know, what it is, and the waiter or waitress doesn't really know. And here they're supplied with all that, which is pretty cool. And I guess there was the ability to put notes on the ticket that was going back to the kitchen. And within reason, I thought, you know, my request wasn't too bad, but, you know, with it, again.
It's within the boundaries of decent, you know, behavior.
But, again, what was interesting is for the chef salad, apparently they would roll whatever they were.
Pinwheels
out of it, which was, again, presentation-wise, was really cool. But, again, it was just another quick story about the pantry diner that keeps.
Yeah, well, apparently it's a great place. I mean, Oceanside is blessed to have such a, you know, wonderful diner there, you know. Yeah, it, you know, people's requests, I go back and forth on it. We're in a service business, and, you know, I've gone way out of my way to make customers happy. I'll tell you a funny story. Tom and Cynthia, who own Sparkling Point, and they've been guests on the show a few years back, came into Amano one night. It was a snowy Wednesday or Tuesday night or whatever it was. And we closed a little bit early. There was nothing going on, you know. I was sitting at the bar, and I'm having a glass of wine with the bartender and yapping with the manager, and they came walking in. And I said, oh, thank God you're still open. And we said, yeah, we're still open, but the kitchen's closed, you know. So I said, oh, my God, we're starving. So I said to him, I said, well, listen, you know, I can go back and turn some stuff on. I don't have anything ready, but if you want like a simple pasta and a salad, I'll be happy to do it. You do that? Yeah, of course I do that, right? And the funny part is it took me 8 minutes maybe to do that. They've been talking about that for like 10 years, you know. It's just a part of the service that sticks in people's heads.
But that's not a life. We've talked about this many times, living life with expectations or whatever. And, you know, usually if you live life without any expectations, it's a smoother journey. But, yeah, when something like that happens, like a silly thing, my son the other night, I like to try all these crazy different flavors that Mountain Dew comes out.
Yeah.
And in today's marketing world, there's just so much cross-marketing. So they partnered with Buffalo Wild Wings, and there's a special flavor that you can only get there. So I saw a commercial.
Blue cheese Gatorade.
It was pretty much that. It was like it's a purple soda.
Oh, God, yeah.
But they had on the commercial that was running on TV, there was something said Long Island Heritage and Mountain Dew. And I said, wow, that would be pretty cool to get that glass.
Sure.
So Nick was taking out food. So I said, just ask about it. And again, he wasn't asking for anything free. And the waitress came back with his order and said, here, take this home with you. You'll enjoy it. And again, it's one of those things. He wasn't, as my dad would try to do, schnurr something.
Schnurring, yeah, yeah.
But he, you know, when you get that unexpected cooperation or whatever, it goes so far.
It does. You know, I'll tell you one quick story before we take a break here. We had a customer, Sydney Felstein. Sydney was the most cantankerous, argumentative, pain in the ass you ever met in your life, and we loved him. He was one of our favorite customers. He was about 80 years old. He ate every lunch he had for 10 years. From the day I opened lunch at Cool Fish until the week he passed away, he was there 5 days a week, never had a good meal, and his soup was never hot enough. Right? So we used to laugh all the time. So one day, you know, it was snowing outside or whatever, and we're waiting for Sydney because we all look forward to him coming in. He was such fun to be around, right? And he'd yell at me all the time, I can't believe the soup's not hot again, send it back. He once sent it back without tasting it, right? And the waitress said, why you said, Sydney, you haven't even tasted it. How do you know it's not hot? How do I know it's not hot? It was like Jackie Mason. How do I know it's not hot? 800 cups of soup. This idiot served me 800 times. It's cold. What, today it's hot? You know, it's hilarious, right? So anyway, Sydney doesn't show up. And we're like, oh, no, what happened, you know? So we're calling the cops. We're calling hospitals. So he finally called his house, you know? He finally answers up. What? What do you want? I said, it's Tom over at Cool Fish. Where are you, you know? He says, I'm in the toilet. I'm like, no, I mean, why aren't you here for lunch? He goes, it's snowing out. I'm afraid to drive. I said, you want us to come and get you? He goes, you do that? I said, of course I do that, right? So we sent somebody to get him. So P.S., from that day on, every time there was a weather event, including like chance of showers or partly cloudy, you know, he'd call up, you know, we had his own personal Uber, whatever they call that thing, right? So we, and I swear everybody wanted to go. Let me go get him. He was fabulous, you know. I tell you, the day he passed away was maybe the saddest day we had at Coolfish. He was just such fun to be around. And anyway, R.I.P. Sidney, you were the best. You were the best. Anyway, let's take a little break and we'll pay some bills and we'll come back and chat some more.
Hi, this is Chad Turnbull, a lifelong Long Islander and the founder of Savorian Wines, a local import wine company. This week, I recommend Loyal Hearts Provence Rosé. Loyal Hearts comes from the world's best regions for rosés. It's not too sweet and not too dry. The perfect combo for the summertime. You can find a bottle of Loyal Hearts at Bottle Buys in Glenhead, Bottle Values in Old Bethpage, Bottle Bargains in Northport, Bottle and Cases in Huntington, and Bottle Hamptons in Southampton. For more quality wine suggestions, just email me at chad@savorian.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Playing with Fire on 1100 WHLI AM and 104.7 WHLI FM. Long Island's own food, wine, and lifestyle show with your host, Tom Shawdell, chef, author, and restaurateur.
Yes, we were talking about great service moments, and I think that, you know, When I reflect back on you know, my whole restaurant deal here for the last 53 years, I can honestly tell you that, you know, great service will rescue a mediocre meal. It won't rescue a horrible meal. I mean, nothing will, but it'll rescue a mediocre meal experience. And I don't think great meals rescue terrible service. I think service is probably the one thing that, you know, almost trumps what the food is going to be like. Because, you know, people's expectation level are different. You know, obviously, if you go to a very expensive restaurant, your expectation level rises and you know, it's justifiable. I get it. And in service in those places is usually pretty good. But if you're just in an average restaurant and you know, you go out, you have a hamburger. A hamburger's a hamburger. No, nobody ever said to me, oh, my God, you got to taste the hamburger over there. It's unbelievable. It's basically the same. It's 80-20. 80% beef, 20% fat, you know, it's round, it goes on a thing, it comes with ketchup, mayonnaise, you know, mustard, you know.
I beg to differ.
Do you?
So.
You've had that fabulous.
I think there can be so many different situations relative to a hamburger.
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly. And you know, if somebody has a different topping or something, it can stand out to some degree. But what I'm saying is if you take the average hamburger that you get in almost every pub on Long Island, right? And if you have lousy service, there's a good chance you're not going back. But if you have the average hamburger everywhere in every pub on Long Island and you have exceptional service, you go back again and again and again. And even if the burger's a little off, like they forgot the ketchup, you know, no big deal, you know. But, or the roll was toasted a little too much or not enough or whatever. You know, great service. I mean, you know, it's the cheers thing. You know, years ago, a friend of mine interviewed James Beard, who is this noted gourmet, you know, gourmand, whatever. And I have this, his home in the West Village is a shrine to his, you know, time with writing about restaurants and cookbooks and things like that. And it's kind of Carnegie Hall for chefs. If you're asked to do a dinner there, you know, it's a big honor, you know, whatever. Anyway, a friend of mine interviewed him for a magazine or whatever. And finally, when it was all over, he says, you know, off the record, Mr. Beard, you've eaten all over the world. What's your favorite restaurant? And he thought about it for a second. He says, you know, my favorite restaurant is the one where everyone knows me. And it stuck in my head. And I always tried to make my, you know, wait staff and my management staff realize that everybody wants to be treated like Norm on Cheers. You know, when you walk in a restaurant, everybody goes, Stu, oh, man, you're back again. I said, hey, the usual for you tonight or what? You know, all of a sudden you feel part of the club. You know, you're in, you know.
So that's a twin-edged sword, though. There's no question that there's a real adrenaline rise with something like that. But if you become too familiar with one restaurant, are you limiting your experiences because you're going to this small circle of restaurants?
Yeah, no, you are. Definitely are. But, you know, there's safety in that. It's like people who order the same wine all the time. You know, they don't want to. You know, experiment, you know, if I say, listen, I'm going to take you to a new place you haven't been before, you know, it's fine. I'm paying a bill and it's no loss if you don't like it, you know. But if you're going to spend, I mean, you know, this week I was over at a restaurant on the North Shore and I basically had a bottle of wine and 12 oysters and it was $204, you know. So some people aren't willing to experiment with that kind of a tab, you know. So they want to go where they know they're going to have a good meal.
No question about it. But in respect to our discussion last week, and we were talking about wine, I found it like really a mind awakening that if you become familiar with a certain wine,
mm-hmm.
and you know that's your go-to wine,
sure.
well, it differs in the different years of a vintage, apparently.
Yeah.
Which is makes it an adventure every time you try something different.
Sure.
But then I was starting to think also, if you become familiar with some brand comes or a vineyard comes to mind, Artesa, out, mm-hmm. I guess, California.
Right.
You know, if you're enjoying their cab, would you also enjoy their Chardonnay or something? Is there something special about what they're doing that sort of ties their vineyard together that, you know, or it's just there's no similarity to cab and to Chardonnay, and there's nothing that the vineyard can do to make that, you know, like a brand. It's not like Pop-Tart's grape version,
right,
Pop-Tart's
right. Yeah,
blueberry
yeah, yeah.
version.
No, I think what happens is, you know, it's the talent of the winemaker and the style of wine that they produce. And, you know, you can love somebody's reds and not like their whites. Like my dear friend Jimmy Waters, I mean, I love him to death. He was a great winemaker out in Long Island for a while. He's retired now. But he made great reds. His whites, okay, you know.
Gotcha. But so that I can understand, I guess, you know, in each different creation, it they might excel or not. But there's definitely no ongoing theme on a vineyard, again, between their reds and whites or whatever. But you said there's the technique or whatever. Like, what would it be? Like,
Well, first of all, it all starts in the vineyard. Vineyard management is key. I mean, if you have a great vineyard manager, you're going to have great wine because the grapes are going to be great, you know, and there's lots of things that can happen out there. I mean, you can have, you know, rot in a rainy season. You can have birds which peck at, you know, everything out there, animals. You know, there's all kinds of shenanigans going on in the vineyard. So a great vineyard manager produces great fruit. It's like you can't make great food without a great product. It's the same thing with wine. You're not going to make great wine without a great product. That said, let's say you get a great product that comes in, it goes into barrels, it goes into tanks, whatever. Then it becomes the task of the winemaker to make sure that wine is going to show as best as it can. If it's a single varietal wine, like 100% Cabernet, well, then you have to know what you're doing with Cabernet. You got to know when to pick it, you know, what the ripeness level is, the Brix levels that you want, you know, which is the sugar measurements in there. And then, you know, how long are you going to keep it in a barrel? Are you going to use new oak? Are you going to use used oak? You know, because each one imparts a different flavor. So that's the talent of the winemaker. Then, you know, taking that a step further, if you're going to do blending, like Bordeaux, most of Bordeaux is a blend, you know. People, you know, it's hilarious to me that people don't know a lot about this, but, you know, people say, oh, I never drink Merlot, but I love Bordeaux. Bordeaux is 90% Merlot, you know. So anyway, most Bordeaux wines are blended. You have the classic five varietal Bordeaux varietals. You have Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Malbec, Petit Verdot, and what's the other one? Merlot. So those are blended. And how each winemaker blends that wine produces the result that they want it to taste like. So when I go to Pominac to make my wines, you know, Kareem is the winemaker there. Kareem and I will sit down and I'll do my blends and come up with what I think is a great wine. He does the same thing, and his blends and my blends are different, you know, and it's just a question of your palate and what you want. Now, I have experience because I've drunk, you know, oceans of wine over the last 40 years, you know, and I have a chef's palate, so I'm kind of in tune to flavors a little bit more than probably the average guy. But the bottom line is, so I'm looking for a wine to match specifically with my style of cooking. And that's what I'm going for. Kareem, on the other hand, has a greater task. He's got to, you know, come up with some general acceptability thing. He wants to make it as good as he can make it, but, you know, it has to sell for him. I don't have to worry about selling a lot of wine. I make 800 cases a year or so, maybe make thousands, you know. So it's a different thing. But it's almost like the Iron, if you watch Iron Chef or you've watched Chopped on TV, anybody's ever watched Chopped, they give each chef a, you know, basket of ingredients and they have to come up with what they think they can do with it. Now, most of it's silly, you know, pig's noses and, you know, jelly beans and, you know, all the stuff that they stick in those baskets. But the bottom line is you have three different chefs or four different chefs, and you have four completely different products with the same ingredients. And the same holds true with wine. You know, you have the juice from the grapes, and then what you do with it afterwards is key to what the wine's going to taste like when it's finally finished. So, you know, to answer your question, is there a, you know, a familiar line that runs through the whole vineyard? Yeah, I guess in the fact that, you know, you have a winemaker who has a good palate and a lot of talent. Aside from that, you know, I mean, you know, Chardonnay and Cabernet are as different as night and day, so it's not really the same, you know, kind of effort. You know, you have to treat them differently and separately. And thank God they do, because that's what makes, you know, that's what makes the wine, I think, so interesting. You know, craft beer is the same way. I mean, you got guys that, you know, can make great beer and guys that can make mediocre stuff, you know. And you know, there's an ass for every chair, as they say, you know. I mean, what you think is a great wine for you, I may go, yeah, it's not for me, you know. And it doesn't, it's like music. Nobody's right or wrong. You know, like Celine Dion, you like Tom Waits. They're probably at the opposite ends of the musical spectrum. But, you know, some people like Celine, some people like Tom. I'm a Tom guy. But, you know, the bottom line is it's an individual thing and there's no right or wrong.
So I have an interesting quandary to ask you. And then I have to ask you to explain the difference between two foods. But the quandary is, had an opportunity to celebrate a friend's birthday. Carrie and I went over to their house. We hadn't seen him for a while. And they're definitely foodies and my mentors in wine. And I brought some good bottles of wine with me. I brought a nice, actually ones you helped me pick. Stag's Leap, I think, was one.
Okay.
And I forget what the other one was. But one was a red and one was a white. And I felt that I needed to quantify the wines, like I wasn't bringing Boone Farm, you know. I said, again, these are good wines, and I said they're like $100 a bottle, and we wouldn't want to share it with anyone else but you. But I felt awkward, you know, saying that, you know, I wasn't trying to be
hoity.
Yeah, but I wanted them to know that it was a special wine, and part of the experience was I wanted to try to figure out if it was worth, you know, making that leap from a $20 bottle of wine to an $85, $90 bottle of wine.
Right. Well, here's the deal. There's no bad juice anymore. You know, 25, 30 years ago, I could taste wines with some people and go, oh, my God, it's horrendous, you know. I haven't tasted a horrendous wine in a long, long time. So I think what happens is, I think what happened was technology caught up with the grape, and you can manipulate wines in bad years. You know, you can do things to wines to kind of make them better. And people have learned a lot. You know, I mean, they share information now. You know, you have schools like Cal Davis out there and you know, they're winemaking schools, and you have a lot of winemakers who studied in Australia and Europe and in South Africa and all of that. And they're coming to America and, you know, and displaying their talents. And, you know, you see it even out east with Sparkling Point. Jill, he's just a brilliant sparkling winemaker, I think, you know, and what he produces out there is as good as anything I've had anywhere in the world, you know. So I think that, you know, the difference between a $20 bottle and a $100 bottle is, you know, how comfortable you are with the $100, you know, out of your pocket.
Well, should I have said, you know, this is an expensive bottle, or just brought it and just...
I don't know. I mean, I probably wouldn't have done that, but it's, you know, I don't think it's out of bounds, you know. I mean, you want people to know. But, you know, the thing is, I mean, I taste wines blind, and I think that's the interesting way to find out what you really like. If you don't tell them, they don't know. So they're not poisoned by the fact that it's an expensive wine, or not poisoned, but, you know, swayed, I should say, by the fact that it's you know, or the fact that it's a label. I mean, I know people who will look at a label. If you put, like, Cake Bread is a very popular Cabernet, you know, in California, Cabernet. And we sell oceans of that wine, right? And I think that some of Pominock's stuff is way better, you know. But, you know, very few people would look at those two labels, you know, Cake Bread being $100 a bottle and Pominock being, let's say, $30, you know, and pick the cake, the Pominock over the Cake Bread. But if you remove the labels and nobody knows, then you pick the wine you like. And more people will be, listen, I did a blind wine tasting for the ladies at the club, right? And they're all kind of label drinkers. And what I mean by that is they, you know, they'll drink brand name wines. You know, I'll have the Sonoma Couture, you know. And if I introduce something else, you know, they'll, no, I'll have the Sonoma Couture. It's almost like a Pavlovian response, you know. And so I did this blind tasting of 10 whites. It was a Sylvaner, a couple of Chardonnays from France. It was a couple of Chardonnays from California, Pinot Grigio, you know, all the usual suspects. Number one wine, the favorite of the entire tasting was Pommenac Chenin Blanc.
Wow.
And I said to them, I said, I am willing to bet $10,000 right now that not one of you would take a Long Island wine to a friend's dinner party because you feel you'd be embarrassed. And they went, yes, that's true. And I said, meanwhile, back at the ranch, this is the wine that you like the most. So why don't you just grow some courage, you know, and stick your chest out. I mean, I do it all the time. I'll bring Long Island wine to.
I enjoy experimenting with Long Island wines, but that's just me.
Listen, I mean, they're look, every wine region makes great wines, and every wine region makes mediocre wines. I've had fabulous wines from France. I've had, again, not so fabulous wines from France. The same is true in Italy. I tell you, I was just recently to a tasting in the city of South African wines that was eye-opening to me. I mean, I've had some of them, you know, all the list of usual suspects, as they say, you know, Pinotage and Chenin Blanc, which is probably the two, you know, grapes that they grow the most down there. But I was surprised to see that they vinify Cinsault, which Cinsault is it's spelled C-I-N-S-A-U-L-T. Cinsault is a grape that's used in the Rhone mostly for blending. I've never seen it on its own. And I tasted it. It was fabulous. And they have great Cab Francs. It was like eye-opening. And the great part about South African wines is, you know, most of them are under $20 retail, you know. So they're very affordable, and they're really good. You should check them out, you know, if you the next time. But my opinion on wine with that is I wouldn't be afraid to bring any wine to a dinner party. I don't care who it was. And, you know, I've been to these dinners that people organize, you know. There's a guy, I won't mention his name because I don't have permission to do it, but he's a private collector. And he has literally, a friend of mine moved his, he had to move his house, so he had to move his wine cellar. My friend helped him. Literally took almost 9 hours to unload his wine cellar. He had 1,800 cases of some of the finest wines in the world that are going for thousands of dollars a bottle. And he's brought these wines to the tasting, and I'll bring something from Pommenac, and some people like them better, you know? I have no problem doing that.
Interesting.
None.
So my other question to you is, the family that we went to have dinner with, the woman was prepared a really nice home-cooked meal. They had just gotten back from Spain.
Uh-huh.
And lo and behold, she was preparing paella.
Really?
And it was marvelous. You know, she just did it really nice. There was a nice presentation. She was explaining to me that at one point you stop stirring it because you cook it over the rice or whatever.
Yeah, you want to burn the bottom.
What do you call it?
Sakarat.
To crust-like.
Yeah, that's called sakarat.
But so my question is, it was wonderful. It was scallops, shrimp, there was chicken thigh, sausage. It was a little bland.
Mm-hmm.
Would it have been insulting if I asked for some salt or something?
Yeah, that's a tough one, you know.
I chose not to.
Yeah, it's, well, discretion is the better
part. But something that
of
was going to be incredible was very nice.
Yeah.
And it just missed.
Well, you know, listen, salting things is the mark of a real good cook. I mean, I go through this all the time with my people. And I look at it like peaks and valleys, right? It's a mountain. Salt's a mountain. And it's a chemical, so you got to be careful, right? If you undersalt something, it's terrible. If you oversalt something, it's terrible. And everybody has a different tolerance for salt, you know?
It's funny because now I'm recollecting as part of the discussion that night, and it was nothing about that I found the paella to be needing some additional spice. Somebody made the comment that lemon can sometimes be used as a substitute for salt in a recipe. Is that?
That's a wives' tale.
Okay.
Yeah. Here's a great example of what I'm talking about. I had a chef who worked for me for a while, and his stuff was always under-seasoned, right? And I used to follow him around, and I'd re-season everything, right? And one time there was this, it was a chili contest that somehow I got myself involved in. I don't know what happened. Anyway, I completely forget about it, right? I'm out east, it's up here, and it's that night, right? So I go like, oh, God. So I call him up, and I said, listen, dude, I need to make a lobster chili. I don't have time. Could you just get this thing going for me? So he says, yeah, of course, you know. So he makes the lobster chili.
Now, is that a white chili or it's still red?
No, it's neither. It's like pinkish, you know, kind of in the middle. Right? So he makes his lobster chili. I get there and it's, I don't want to say it's awful, but it was less than what I needed.
Less
right?
than stellar.
So I got to fix the whole thing. So it takes me another hour. I fix the chili, right? So I go to the contest and, you know, and I win, right? So they give me this trophy with a lobster on it. And I got to go back and I don't have the heart to tell him that I doctored the whole thing, right? So I come back and I said, hey, listen, you know, congratulations, your chili won the contest. I give him the trophy, you know. He said, yeah, I knew that stuff was killer. And I'm thinking, oh, my God. You know? We've since had a falling apart, you know. But I never told him. I didn't have the heart to tell him. But my point is he was always under seasoning stuff. And I always used to go behind him. And finally I sat him down. I said, listen, you got to kind of get a handle on this because I'm exhausted running behind you with all this, you know. And he goes, well, you know, the thing is, you know, if they need more salt, it's on the table. And my position is, once they have to reach for the salt shaker, they've already made a determination about your food, just like you were saying, you know. It was wonderful, but it needed a little salt, you know. So you've already made that thing in your head like, okay, this was all right, but it could have been better, you know.
So this is so funny because one of the things I wanted to talk about today, and we really won't get a chance to, but I'll leave it with our audience to interchange with us through fire@whli.com. And my question or my request to our listeners is, what's the difference between chili and a sloppy Joe? And we won't talk about it today as we get...
You all right over there?
Oh, my God. I should have hit the cough button.
That's the one where the wires aren't connected.
But just share with us your opinions. What is chili? What you make a sloppy Joe with, or what? So let's get some opinions. But as we get near the end of the program, I want to give you some time to wrap it up.
Well, it's not quite yet. We still have a little time. I got my timer on here. We got some time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. I can cough a little more.
Do you want me to tell you my opinion on chili and sloppy
If we
Joe's?
Have the time. I didn't know that we did.
We do. We have about 10 minutes or so left. Yeah, well, to me, the difference between chili and sloppy Joe is chili, you know. Chili's called chili not because it's cold outside. It's called chili because there are chilies in it that make it, you know, spicy. So sloppy Joe's to me is just ground beef that's, you know, kind of mixed with some tomato product and you know, maybe some green peppers or something like that. You know, barbecue-y kind of stuff that's served on
so
a roll.
So what takes it from there to chili is
yeah,
the
real
peppers.
Chili to me, I don't use chopped meat. I use the – what happens, you know, when you're in a commercial kitchen, let's say I'm using, you know, filet mignon or I'm using, you know, sirloin steaks. There's a part of the sirloin that I can't use because there's a vein running through it. Now, there are some chefs out there that go, well, I use those for the well-done ones. Well, why do you want to punish the well-done people? I mean, you know, it's like crazy. You just give them a less than, you know, perfect steak is, to me, criminal. I mean, especially at the prices now. So I take that side, and it's probably about maybe 20% of the strip or the filet ends, and I just dice them finely, and I make, you know, I make bolognese out of it, or I make, you know, chili out of it, something like that.
Well, it's funny. I've been to some different, I guess, food tasting events with chili, and just like you're saying, a lot of people use chunks of meat or shredded meat or whatever.
Sure.
I'm a big proponent of chopped ground beef.
Yeah.
So that would be my personal go-to. But again, it's pretty interesting what you just said, you know. You can have ground beef with a tomato base, which could be your sloppy Joe.
Right.
And then traditional chili is with the spice. What was also interesting in reading an article about this was that sloppy Joe, some people put on like mashed potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
Other people put it on a white rice. And then the choice of bread. In today's world, everybody's doing sourdough and stuff.
Sure.
It brought me back to my youth because I think sloppy Joe actually was something they served at the school lunch on a hamburger roll.
Couldn't wait for that, you know. That was the big hot lunch, you know.
And that definitely wasn't tenderloin pieces.
Yeah.
That was definitely the ground beef.
Well, you can, I like giving that, you know, like a, you know, I don't serve it, but, you know, for the kids or something, if I'm home or, you know, on a lunch menu, sometimes I have a little fun with that and make like a sloppy Jose and give it like a kind of a Spanish flair, you know, with pico de gallo and some avocado and stuff like that, you know. It's fun to experiment with that. You know, chopped meat is fed hundreds and millions of people for hundreds of millions of years. You know, it's just it's a staple, a hamburger thing. And it's not wrong to make chili with chopped meat. It's fine. You know, I prefer the other thing because I'd rather have the sirloin in there, and I like the spoon to stand up. You know, in the chili.
It's just so funny. I just had this remembrance of elementary school on the cafeteria line, and if I look back, it's almost like what the stereotypical prison meal would be.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you walk with your tray,
yeah,
and somebody was taking a spoonful of throwing this and throwing that. I'll bet you the kids today have no idea about a cafeteria, really what it's all about. I would have to guess that it's not what we grew up with.
No, you had those
probably
ladies.
All prepackaged.
Yeah,
today.
You had those grandma ladies with the hairnets and the big boobs and, you know, they had a brooch on one of them. You know, it was like hilarious. You know, it's funny. My high school, Carl Place High School, one of the moms in the PTA called me up. This is about 10 years ago, and asked me if I would come down there and talk to them about improving the high school food. And I'm like, yeah, okay. So I get there, right, and we're sitting in the cafeteria. And I said, you know, the thing is, it's hard to get fancy. You know, you're charging $2.12 for the, you know, meal or whatever. But we actually did. We actually put some things on the menu that were healthier and a little more fun, much to the chagrin of whoever was the contract person, and because they, you know, they didn't want any part of me and my ideas. But anyway, the bottom line was I'm sitting in the cafeteria, right, and I'm looking around, and I start to giggle, right? So the principal, who wasn't the principal when I was there, he says, what are you laughing at? I said, you know, the funny part about this whole thing is when I was here, all you did was throw me out. Now I'm out. You want me back in? It's like, you know, if the worm has turned, you know.
That is very funny.
So he goes, hey, is there anything I can, you know, give you for helping us, you know? No, I said, I'm good, you know. So he gave me this T-shirt. It's a long sleeve black T-shirt with CP on it, you know, which I still wear it all the time. I said, you know what you can give me? One of those trays. And he goes, really? I said, yeah, the trays, they all had the circles on it with the, you know, dot, dot, dot moving through it. You know, every cafeteria had the same one. And I have it home. You know, I have it home. I haven't hung it on the wall or anything with my art, but.
I know there was a symmetry between you and I. I went to the local restaurant supply, Bar Boy over
yeah, Bar
in
Boy. Sure.
Farmingdale.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, they had trays. And I said, I'm going to get one. So when I eat at my desk, instead of eating on my PowerPoint presentation.
Don't make me describe the desk. Please don't make me describe your desk.
But I have my orange tray.
Yeah. Listen, this is, you know, I value that thing.
It's, probably
you know,
can't find it on the mess on my desk.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah. My high school career was interesting, I'll say, to say the least. Yeah. I couldn't get there quite as often as they thought I should, you know. And it was funny because they used to, if you cut out of school, they would suspend you, right, for 3 days. And I'm thinking, this is great. They haven't thought this through. You know, I don't want to be here to begin with, right? So if I take off one, they give me three as a reward. Perfect, you know. My parents didn't think so, but I did.
So I have to stress you out, but this is for a good reason. So we talked about Steve Vai and Joe Bonamassa and sure. Joe Satriani. So
all great guitar players.
Joe Bonamassa will be playing at Jones Beach in a couple of weeks, and I believe we're going to get a chance to interview him.
Nice.
And I used you and your friendship with Steve Vai as the means by which to get the interview, because I think it would be pretty cool insight to share, you know, your relationship with Steve.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously Steve knows Joe.
Yeah.
So I think it will be interesting content for the radio show. Plus, it will be one of our first interviews with a musical celebrity other than what you bring to the table.
Yeah, well, we've had a couple. We had Steve on the show, and we had remember the opera singer? We had the opera singer on the show.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember his name, but he said, you know, he would sing the answers, you know. I'd say, so, you know, when did you start cooking? When I was a kid, you know, kind of thing.
That's pretty funny.
Like, yeah, it was great.
But well, the stress on you is going to be we're going to have to figure a compatible time where he can call, Joe Bonamassa can call in, and I can patch you in somewhere.
I think he should be the one to be inconvenienced. You know, it's like he's got more time on his hands than I do.
You would think, but the way they say it, it's not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's funny, you know, when Steven was inducted into the Long Island Hall of Fame, Long Island Music Hall of Fame, he asked me to do the induction ceremony speech, you know. So I had to meet them two blocks away, and then they put us in these fancy ZZ Top cars and brought us to the front, you know, driving up, whatever. It's all, you know, Hollywood works in strange ways. I mean, if you saw how movies were made. They're nothing like the final product, you know? And it's the same thing with this production. So we drive up and I get out of the car with Gene and Steve got out with his wife, Pia. And as we're walking in, the red carpet, you know, there's like 60, 70 people. And we're like, Tom, hey, T, what's up? And Steve's going, wait, whoa, I'm the guy here, you know? And I said to him, you put out an album once every 2 years. People eat three times a day. Who do you think they're going to talk to?
Wow, now I can relate to that story of Bill O'Leary asking for my autograph.
That's fabulous, man, you know? Was that the only time? Has anybody else ever asked you? You know, I signed an autograph on a plane. We got a couple of minutes left. I was on a plane. I brought a guitar on a plane. I was in my 20s. Maybe I was 23, 24 years old. And so I didn't want to check the guitar. So I detuned the strings. So I didn't bring it. I'm going to put it in the overhead bin or in the front. So I walk on with this guitar, right? And I'm sitting down, and finally I hear this woman behind me talking to her daughter, right? And she goes, you're Dave Manson, aren't you? Is that a cross between Dave Mason and Charlie? You know? So I go, no, that's Mason, correcting it. She goes, I knew it. Because apparently I look like him. You know, we both had brown hair and a beard instead of guitar. So she goes, you know, Dave Mason, oh my God, how's it, you know, she's carrying on. Oh, my daughter, could you say hello to my daughter? And my girlfriend at the time is going, why don't you sign her an autograph, Dave? You know, you know, being sarcastic. And a woman goes, would you? I'm like, of course. So I actually signed Dave Mason's autograph in a plane. I hope the woman's not listening.
So real quick, so I'm working for a limo company. I'm I guess it was Delta International. And I think I see Kanye West. This goes back 15 years ago. So I discreetly go over and I said, could I please get an autograph? And nobody believed me that I got Kanye West's autograph. But I went to the Google and images, and he would sign it with like a Mickey Mouse head as part of his thing.
Yeah.
So unless the guy was really good at fooling people, how would he know to sign it that way? Yeah. So I believe I have a real Kanye West autograph.
When my daughter was very young, she had a book, you know, because, you know, being in the restaurant business in Montauk and the Hamptons, you know, you see a lot of celebrities. So she got to meet a lot of them, you know, Greg Allman and Waylon Jennings was out there, Paul Simon, Paul McCartney, all of that, right? So I'm sitting in Nick and Tony's one night, and Paul McCartney comes in, and he's sitting right next to me, right? So I call her up, and I'm whispering. I said, hey, Courtney, guess who's here? Guess who's sitting next to me? Guess who? I said, Paul McCartney. She goes, Dad, you got to ask him for his autograph. I said, I can't. I'm an adult. I can't do that. You know, she's still mad at me about that. So 40 years later or whatever, you know. But, you know, you see people going over to these people, just torturing them, you know. And I tell you what, as far as celebrities go, he's probably one of the nicest guys you could ever meet. He's very cordial. He's very upbeat.
They say, you experienced it because I know you said you once had a conversation with him.
Yeah.
But, he's willing to talk to people. Don't ask to take a picture or sign an autograph. That sort of spoils the mood.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I'm not one of those stargazers. I don't really care all that much about it. You know, Paul McCartney was interesting to me because he was like the basis of my whole childhood. You know, I mean, the Beatles and growing up and playing guitar and all that stuff. But, you know, and all I said was, hey, thanks for the music. I mean, it was just, you know, it's one thing. Anybody can write a song. I've written 20 or whatever, you know. And, you know, one or two of them are pretty good. 300? That's another story. And there's very few clunkers in there when they were with the Beatles. I mean, separately, you know, I can do without Obladi Oblada, but, you know, for the most part, you know, it's a body of work that's probably never going to be duplicated.
So real quick before we leave. So our friend Rob Rush, who is one of the DJs on 94.3 The Shark, is up in Oyster Bay on Audrey Avenue by the Oyster Bay Brewing Company for their block party last week. Guy pulls up in a motorcycle wearing a helmet and sunglasses, and he goes, oh, The Shark, I really like that station. He goes, are you one of the on-air people? And Rob said yes, and turns out it was Billy Joel.
Yeah, he's always
but the
up
only
there.
Thing that the only thing Rob could get out of his mouth was, wow, I really like your music.
Yeah, well, it's all you need, you know. Anyway, we're going to close the show with Tom's Three Keys to Life, which are, as usual, life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last and keep chocolate in your life as important as sex and pizza. Happy Father's Day to all you dads out there, and we'll see you next week.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shordell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at amanorestaurant.com.
This is Chad Turnbull, a lifelong Long Islander and the founder of Savorian Wines, a local import wine company. This week, I recommend Santa Francesca, a wine produced from Alto Alagir. This region is home to another famous Santa, but without the cost for marketing in each bottle, just added quality. Pick up a bottle of Santa Francesca at Bottle Buys in Glenhead, Bottle Values in Old Bethpage, Bottle Bargains in Northport, Bottle Hampton in Southampton, and Bottles and Cases in Huntington. For more quality wine suggestions, just email me, chad@savorian.com.
First, there was Tuesday. Then, there was Taco Tuesday. Now at Wendy's, there's Takis Tuesday. Get a new Takis Fuego meal, a.k.a. Takis Fuego chicken sandwich, Fuego fries inspired by Takis, a bag of Takis Fuego chips, a small drink, and also a small Frosty classic. Yes, you can get that any day, but on Takis Tuesday, the Frosty is free. Make every Tuesday a Takis Tuesday. Gotta be Wendy's.
Limited time only. Participating U.S. Wendy's includes 1 ounce Takis Fuego chips while supplies last. Takis and Fuego trademarks are used under license.